Welcome back to the Old Frontline podcast. It's been a busy few weeks for me, and I've been offline for a big chunk of it, moving house from Yorkshire down to Kent. I've lived in Elsica for over 7 years, working up at the head office of Ledger Battlefield Tours as part of my job as head battlefield guide. But more and more of my work has taken me across to Europe these days, and I've moved down Kent to be nearer to the heart of our European operations. And while it saddens me to leave dear little Elsica behind, it's a place that I grew to love. I've mentioned it many, many times on this podcast and become quite connected to the stories of the local men, the local regiments from that area of South and across to East Yorkshire, having walked much of the Wolds and the East Yorkshire coast. And of course, that will never really leave me. And I've come back to Kent in many ways because I lived here in Kent near to Canterbury for a long, long time in between my stints over there on the old front line. And living here now will make it a lot easier for my job. But also there's a wider aspect for this podcast in that I'll be much, much nearer to those battlefields of the Great War. When I lived in Kent before, it was quite common just to nip across for a day trip to visit the Somme or the Forgotten Front in northern France or across to Flanders, and I'll be doing that again. And we'll return to kind of how this move will impact what we do, positively impact what we do on the podcast later on in this episode, which is a bit of a kind of interim episode, really. It's not a full episode. Well, over the course of the next few weeks, we'll get back to normal. We've got a few guests coming up, and I've got some of the podcast ideas that I've been developing that we'll put out as episodes. So this is my first episode of the podcast recorded here in Kent. I'm actually standing amongst the chaos of having moved. Those of you who've moved recently or moved in your life will know that moving is a stressful time, a busy time, and a time of chaos once you have moved in, with boxes all over the place. And I'm standing in what is officially a dining room, but it will become my library and probably the place where I will continue to record the podcast. And I'm surrounded by piles and piles of books connecting the Great War to the Second World War and vice versa. And being in this location in Kent, only, 10 miles or less from the coast, less than 15 miles from the Sussex border, my old homeland, the chalk downlands of Sussex, and all those little villages that connect me so deeply to the history of the men of the South Downs battalions, the Cinque Ports battalions, and many other Sussex stories of the Great War, some of which I've relayed here on previous episodes of the podcast. I'm very much also, being down here in Kent, at a place that greatly connects us to the First World War. Whenever I begin a battlefield tour with Ledger and we head off down to the Channel Tunnel or to the port, I always discuss the fact here we are starting a tour like that, heading across to the Western Front in Kent, and it's a very suitable, very apt place to do that, really. Because if you went back to the period of the Great War, then this county would very much have been a military county during those years of 1914-18. There would have been khaki everywhere. You had training camps right across Kent, just down the road in Folkestone. The Canadians were there for a very long time. The Chinese Labour Corps were there. Then over in Dover itself, you had one of the main logistics routes to the front line. Going back to Folkestone, that was the main route for troops, particularly those coming on leave. Men would come back from the front to Boulogne via rail and then get a leave ship across to Folkestone, and then trains would take them up to London Victoria normally, and then from there they would change in London to go off and return to wherever they came from in Great Britain. And right across the county were supply and ammunition depots of material being gathered, ready to be shipped. The trains were running probably almost night and day, taking war material to be sent across to the Western Front. And the civil population of Kent had the kind of constant reminder of the war, not just with what they saw, but with what they heard as well. They could hear it as well, like a distant rumble of thunder in the distance. The bombardment's just across the channel. You know, if I'm only 10 miles from the coast here, it's 20-odd miles across to France, and then, what, 40 miles or so to the nearest point of the Western Front. So in some of those intense bombardments during, particularly in Flanders, during, for example, Messines in 1917 and Third Ypres, and most likely when the Germans attacked during the Battle of the Lys in April 1918, that sound of war, like thunder, like some great rage in the distance, could be heard across the channel. So the war for the civil population as well as the military population of Kent during the Great War was kind of ever present, really. So I kind of feel myself being very much back in the heart of the story of the Great War and the Western Front. And of course, I'm, in many respects, I'm living back on a battlefield, because in the skies above where I'm living was the Battle of Britain in another war, in the Second World War. And right across this county, there is evidence of the dead of both world wars in the cemeteries here. And that's something that in future episodes that I'll look at down the road is Shorncliffe Military Cemetery. And we kind of started a World War One at Home kind of episodes some time ago, and we'll probably return to that in the coming months. But looking ahead, of course, now being this close to getting across to the battlefields, that means that I can get over and record episodes on the ground more frequently, talk to people out there, do some interviews over there, which I plan to do. And so hopefully this is opening up a new and exciting aspect of what we do with the Old Frontline podcast. And on top of producing the audio podcasts, we'll also be looking with the Old Frontline to start making some videos. Now, I've started this already. If you go onto our YouTube channel, and I'll put a link to that on the webpage for this episode, you'll see something I recorded earlier this year when I walked across Hawthorne Ridge and talked about some of the stories there. It's a way of bringing some of the stories that we've told on the podcast, bringing them to life in a different way by doing it visually, with a bit of storytelling, a bit of walking the ground, a bit of archive film. And I'm lucky to have quite a lot of that banked away that we can use for these videos. And over the course of this winter, I'll be travelling across the battlefields, recording a few video podcasts for the YouTube channel. I've got a couple already banked that I recorded back in the spring up in Flanders using a new 4K camera. Thanks to those who support the podcast via Patreon and Buy Me a Coffee, I was able to get this kit. But it's caused a bit of a problem in that the 4K video is such high definition that my old Mac kind of struggles to edit it. So I've got to get that sorted out so I can edit those couple of films and get those onto the channel. But there's some more in the pipeline. And again, I'll kind of come back to that later on in this podcast. But just returning to the move that I've made, obviously when you kind of put your life into boxes and then you unbox it and you start going through things, you come across all sorts of stuff that you'd forgotten. So in this next little section of this interim podcast, what kind of things has the move prompted, really? What have I thought about as I've unpacked these books and looked through these papers? And that's what we'll talk about next. So over the last couple of weeks, I've been carrying out what I've described as Operation Bookshift, which is moving my library and archives from Yorkshire down here to Kent. And as you can imagine, I've got one or two books connected to the subject of the Great War. Some of these books have been with me many, many years. It's interesting to open them up and see how cheap some of them were when I first bought them in the 1980s. First editions of Great War memoirs for 50 pence. I mean, there were so few people interested in those days that you could pick up those kind of bargains. And everywhere you went, right across this part of Kent and Sussex, there were secondhand bookshops everywhere, absolutely kind of ram full of this stuff. And I just didn't have enough money and didn't have enough space to kind of keep buying things in those days. But since then, of course, my library has greatly, greatly expanded. And unpacking the books, you kind of see the names of authors that have had a great influence on you. Lynn MacDonald. I'd started in the last week or so listening to some audio books of Lynn MacDonald's books that are now on Spotify. And although I've read them all, it's quite interesting to kind of listen to them as you're kind of working, or as in this case, as I was packing boxes full of books. But I remain absolutely convinced that her work has not just influenced me and prompted me to kind of get out to the battlefields and discover more, but I'm sure many of you listening to this will have a very similar experience. Lynn's work really is quite incredible, and the way that she recorded those veterans of the Great War. And kind of scanning across the shelves as I've put books onto them, John Giles, founder of the Western Front Association, his Eat Then and Now, Somme Then and Now, and his Western Front Then and Now, only really indicating a fraction of the knowledge that he had and a fraction of the experience. Really, those were kind of seminal books in those early years of visiting the battlefields and the foundation of the Western Front Association. And they really, you know, again, had a great influence on me in the way that I saw and understood the landscape of the First World War. And they deserve really to be wider known. You can still pick up first editions of some of his Then and Now books on eBay, for example, very, very cheaply. And After the Battle did a reprint of them, which I think Pen and Sword now do those. So we'll put a link to those on the podcast website as well. But while I was opening one book, a little in memoriam card fell out, and it was a memorial card to Tony Spagnoli. Now, Tony Spagnoli, Spag or Spaggers as he was often called, is perhaps a name that some of you have never encountered before. And I was surprised and probably a little bit shocked to see that Tony had died as long ago as 2008. He never got to see the Great War centenary. He never got to see all that interest, that public interest. He never even lived to see the 90th anniversaries, when so much was done by the BBC and there was so much on the television and quite a lot of engagement then. But Tony was an early pioneer, like Lynn MacDonald and John Giles, an early pioneer of the Great War in many respects. Lesser known, but his work is really important. And I kind of felt that it was perhaps an opportunity to talk about him here, and I'm sure we might well return to him when we trudge some of the ground in Flanders in due course. So I met Tony Spagnoli through the Western Front Association. I came across him most likely when he gave a talk at one of the national meetings, which used to be held in the National Army Museum in Chelsea, or at perhaps a local branch. And it was quite clear that he had this incredible knowledge of the First World War and ability to present that knowledge in an engaging and interesting way. And through him, or perhaps via John Drey, I met John Drey, someone I've spoken about many times on this podcast, of a teenage Tommy who served in the Second World War, a veteran of Monte Cassino, lived in the shadow of his father, had served with the Northamptonshire Regiment in the Great War, and was wounded three times at Lewes, at Trones Wood, and then at Bellawada on the 31st of July 1917. John's dad had died when he was just 12, and he'd inherited his medals and his battalion histories of the North Ants and his copies of The Great War Illustrated. And John had become totally obsessed with the First World War, which had kind of led him down this path into becoming an underage volunteer in World War II. And when I met him, John was in his late 60s, early 70s then, and he became part of my original team of Ledger guides when we first began to do battlefield tours for Ledger in 1997. But through him, I got to know Tony Spagnoli in the late 80s and early 90s. And at that stage, Tony had not written very much. He'd done quite a lot of articles for Stand 2. And if you're a member of the Western Front Association, you can go onto their website and download as PDFs the early editions of Stand 2. And again, I've got a whole pile of those in binders that are sitting on my shelves right alongside me as I record this. And it's quite interesting flicking through those to see the kind of articles that that are in there. Some really, really interesting stuff. And Spag would often kind of pick some very unusual stories where he'd come across some material or the name of an officer, and he'd researched it through in memoriam volumes and school rolls of honour and newspapers and all kinds of things. And he'd really bring these people to life. He called them cameos, that these individual stories of people were kind of cameos of soldiers. And although they were about specific people, they helped to tell kind of wider story, really, of the Great War. Now, Tony Spagnoli was a veteran himself. He'd served in the Royal Navy on HMS Belfast during the Normandy operations and in the final year of the Second World War, and indeed post-war. And him and John Drey had been friends for many years. They ended up working in a company together in London, where somebody had said, oh, you should talk to John or you should talk to Tony, whichever way round it was, because he's also interested in that crazy war that you like, the First World War, the Great War. And they became firm friends. And one of the things that they did together in the 60s and 70s is take a little minibus across to the battlefields with Great War veterans in it. So they would scoop up a load of veterans that they got to know and interviewed, and then find out where they'd fought, and then take them over on a pilgrimage to the battlefields to visit those places where they'd been as young men. So they had some really incredible stories to tell. But Tony Spagnoli's knowledge, because of his frequent visits with John or on his own or with others, he had this incredible knowledge of the battlefields and the stories that connected the fields and the lanes and the silent cities. And I think I was greatly influenced by his approach. I kind of like to think that the echoes of so many people come through this podcast, and Tony Spagnoli is really certainly very much at the top of the list of those people. He was a founder member of the Western Front Association, along with John Giles and John Drey. There was that famous moment, I remember John Giles telling me that they, about a year before the WFA was formed, they all sat together in a cafe in the square at Ypres, and John Giles slammed his fist down on the table and said, "We will form this organisation." And the WFA came into being the following year in 1980. And they made it very much an organisation of which the veterans were at the heart of it. And I remember when I joined in 1982, going to one of the first meetings up in the National Army Museum, the first two or even three rows of seats were reserved for veterans. It just shows how many veterans attended some of these early meetings. And as I've probably recounted on this podcast before, it was not just kind of any old veterans, but there were authors amongst them as well. Charles Carrington, Herbert Saltzbach, Norman Gladden, they were all there, and I got to meet them and had the privilege of talking to them. And in the case of Norman Gladden, he very kindly signed a copy of Across the Piave, his book about the time in Italy at the end of the First World War. And so Tony Spagnoli was very much involved in those early days of the WFA, and I think he helped shape, amongst many others, as to what it became. And there was a great sense for me, being a young man then, surrounded by these giants of First World War history, like John Giles, John Terrain, Tony Spagnoli and many others. The generosity that they all had in sharing their knowledge, in telling you things, in giving you contacts, in introducing you to people, and sharing, you know, material with you, you know, sending you maps from the official history, photocopying things for you, lending you books. I mean, it was really quite something. And with Spag, it was his generosity of knowledge, the way that he would openly and really willingly share what he knew, so that when you were off to the Somme, you didn't miss out on visiting this, or if you were going up to Flanders, don't forget to visit this little cemetery off the beaten track, because in there you'll find the grave of whoever it was, and he'd tell you the story and you'd go and visit it. So that is something that I've always carried with me, and partly, I guess, is what inspired this podcast, is to kind of share knowledge. It's really important. There's no point in keeping this kind of stuff to yourself, because what's the point, really? You know, you want more people to understand and appreciate and connect and remember. And that's kind of what the sharing of knowledge is really all about. And what Spag did is he wrote, as I said, quite a few articles in the early Stan Twos, but he twinned up with a friend of his, Ted Smith, who set up a little publishing company, and they began to publish a series of paperback books called Cameos of the Great War, going back to his idea of having these kind of cameos, stories of soldiers, and Salient Points. That was a whole series of books about the war in Flanders and the stories of men who had fought in Flanders during the Great War. Now, some of these are still in print, although sadly Ted Smith has joined Tony Spagnoli in the long, long trail. He's faded away too. The books appear to still be in print, and I'll put a link to those on the podcast website, but they are very easy to get hold of via eBay or A-Books and all these other places where you can be seduced into buying far too many books. And through those, he wrote a kind of whole series. He brought these cameos together and wrote some fantastic little books full of really intimate, interesting stories about men who fought and died in the battlefields of the Western Front. And there are two of these books that really kind of stand out for me. One of those is A Walk Round Plugstert, or Plug Street, as the British Tommy called it. This was a little book that he did because Tony particularly loved to walk that part of the battlefields, and he had so many stories that he'd researched. I mean, it is a part of the front where so many crisscross paths of the Great War come together. Winston Churchill was there as a battalion commander. Roland Layton, fiancé of Vera Brittain, immortalised in her book Testament of Youth, was there and sent poems and flowers to her from that part of the battlefield. There was the Christmas truce. There were teenage soldiers. There's so many stories, and he kind of brought that together in a really excellent little book that kind of defines that part of the battlefield south of Ypres. But there is another book that he did that is lesser known, and that's a book on a part of the 3rd Ypres battlefields at Celtic Wood called Anatomy of a Raid, where it looked at a trench raid on the position around Celtic Wood by a battalion of the Australian Imperial Force in October of 1917. And these men had gone into action and most of them had disappeared and their fate largely remained unknown. And Tony was captivated by this story. He was a greatly religious man, very spiritual man, and he felt a great spiritual connection to the men of the Great War and the battlefields of the Great War. And as part of his research, and some of you who listen to this will think, probably raise your eyes at this point, but kind of part of the story came to Tony in a dream. I remember him telling me this. He almost felt the kind of ghosts of Celtic Wood reach out to him and kind of lead him to where the sources of the story was. And he wrote this book, kind of unravels what happened to these young men of this Australian battalion who was there at that time. And it led him to want to kind of memorialise them in a way. And what he did in the early 90s is pay for a plaque to go up on the wall of St George's Memorial Church in Ypres. If you've been in there, as you walk in through the front door, there are quite a few plaques up on the wall as you immediately come in. And one of those is the plaque that Tony Spagnoli put up. And we had a little meet up there. A few of us went across. John Laffin, the Australian military historian who was living in Britain at that time, he joined us and we had a little memorial service to those diggers who had fallen in that obscure little action at Celtic Wood in October 1917. And I always think of Tony every time I go into St George's, the day we all sat there and then we went down a local bar and we kind of toasted them afterwards. And I was so privileged to walk the battlefields with him, both on the Somme and up on the northern France area around Richebourg and up in Flanders on kind of quite a few occasions, many occasions really. And I miss those times when you could just kind of walk with those walking encyclopedias like John Trey and Tony Spagnoli and many others. And we'd stop and they'd say, you know, see that field over there. So-and-so fought in that and this happened there and so on. And I learned so much from them. And it's, you know, I think part of me, as I say, there are echoes throughout this podcast in every episode. And the echo of people like that is very much present in all the work that I've ever done as a Great War public historian. And kind of looking through the old pages of Stan 2 and some of these books and that memorial card to Spaggers falling out of that book kind of made me reflect on this and probably reflect on it a bit more, which may pop up in subsequent editions and episodes, as it were, of the podcast. Now, aside from unboxing books that I've had for many, many years, I did, during the course of my moving, acquire a couple of new books. I don't think you ever stop acquiring books one way or another. I was very kindly sent a copy of Michael Palin's book, and that is definitely something we will return to in a future podcast. But a good friend who very kindly and generously helped me move the Old Frontline archives, which I didn't want to trust to a removal company. We were chatting away in the journey down from Yorkshire to Kent, and he was telling me about a book on the 3rd Battalion, the Parachute Regiment in the Falklands, which is called 3 Days in June. Now, you might ask yourself, you know, what has this got to do with the Great War? Well, the author of that book, a veteran of that battalion, James O'Connell, put this book together over many, many years by interviewing hundreds of members of his unit and supporting units, and indeed some of those on the other side of the battlefield, Argentinians who'd fought against them, and produced this absolutely fantastic account of their parts in the Falklands conflict. And just reading the introduction to the book, it kind of reminded me, really, it brought me back to Le MacDonald, it brought me back to Pericard, the Frenchman who interviewed all those veterans of Verdun and produced that fantastic book in the 1920s and 30s. It made me think of Martin Middlebrook and all the work that he did in interviewing people for the first day of the Somme and Kaiser's Battle and all the subsequent books that he wrote, including one on the Falklands War, and how important this kind of task is of bringing together these memoirs of men who fought in conflict. This is a more recent conflict. I say recent, I mean, it's kind of 4 decades now since the Falklands War. But reading James O'Connell's account of how he did it by travelling all over the place and interviewing people and writing down notes and what he got from that and what he realised is that men see only a very small portion of their war, of their battlefields, you know, the ground that's quite literally in front of them. And I often see, you know, academic historians discount oral history. And of course it has its problems. I mean, I interviewed veterans of the First World War who told me things that I knew were absolutely not true. They were kind of barrack room stories or estaminet stories, as I kind of like to call them. But there were others like Harry Coates, Alf Rizel, who had this kind of incredible ability to retell their experience. It had been kind of bottled up inside them for decades and decades, and suddenly someone comes along and presses the right kind of buttons and gets them to talk, and out it all comes. And when you kind of compared what they said to official accounts and so on, it pretty much matched up. Now, that didn't happen all the time, but one man's experience is not every man's experience of anything. But the value, I think, of oral historian is to give you an insight into the experience of combat. And this book by James O'Connell on the Falklands very much does that. And it reminded me of so many books that I have on my shelves here that do that for the Great War, and indeed for the other Great War, for the Second World War as well. And again, it then, of course, made me reflect, going through the stuff as I unpacked it, I came across a lot of material on the veterans that I knew, that I interviewed during those years of the 1980s and 90s when that was possible. And I kept, as I've said before in previous episodes, I kind of kept doing that for as long as I could. But it got to a point, particularly in the 90s, where they were beginning to fade away, and that generation who could vividly recount the war, who were old men, but not that old at that stage, they could still tell you something meaningful. I think in the next decade that followed, as we got into the early 2000s, what Great War veterans were able to kind of relate seemed pretty one-dimensional to me compared to the likes of the veterans that I'd interviewed a decade or so before. But nevertheless, veterans' accounts remain really important. And talking to my friend who very kindly gifted me that book about the Falklands, he'd never knowingly met a Great War veteran and regretted that. And I regretted it for him as well, because, you know, it was just an incredible experience, humbling experience. But they've left us this huge legacy. I mean, if you go onto the Imperial War Museum website, there are so many recordings on there you can listen to now. And there are so many memoirs of the Great War that veterans wrote, some of them still being published. These new accounts of the Great War still turn up and are still being put into print. And as I go through my own papers, I come across stuff. I come across the papers of Malcolm Vivian, a veteran that I've mentioned a few times on this podcast, who was from a well-to-do family. His father had married an American and he'd gone to public school, was educated at Cambridge, and he was commissioned into the Royal Garrison Artillery and served as a forward observation officer with them on the Western Front from 1916 until he joined the Royal Flying Corps and Royal Air Force in the final year of the war and trained first as an observer and then as a pilot. And once that training was over, dangerous training, which he was lucky to survive in some respects, once that was over, the war was finished and he never flew in combat. But he'd spent from the spring of 1916 through to the early months of 1918 on the Western Front at the Somme and Flanders, up on the Flemish coast around Nieuport, and also extensively around Arras, where I've mentioned him a few times. And he used to write to me at one stage two or three times a week, where he would just start writing about a subject. He'd say, "I'm going to tell you how a forward observer worked," and 10, 12 pages of script would follow. And then the following week he'd say, "I'll tell you about the technical abilities of a 9.2-inch howitzer," and then that would come through with 10 or 12 sheets of paper, and it would go on. And he'd talk about his brother who died in Flanders in 1917 and his other brother who was gassed with the Duke of Cornwall's light infantry. And I've got all these letters, and I looking through them as I unpack them, that's definitely something I need to put together and do something with for this podcast, because there's some great little stories in there, the tales of Malcolm Vivian, and there's a few others besides. So I guess moving house, it's a good thing. It's brought me nearer to the old front line, and we're going to be doing a lot more actually over on the battlefields for this podcast. But it's made me reflect by looking through these books, thinking about the legacy of historians past and the authors that have had great influence on us. And I think that's really, really important to do so. And I hope as well that it might inspire some of you listening to this to go and find some of these books by John Giles. I'm sure you may well have read Lynn MacDonald and Martin Middlebrook, but John Giles, lesser known, and Tony Spagnoli, his books, easy reads, nice little digestible stories, and in all cases, very easy and great to relate to the battlefields as they are today. And his cameos, really, have had a great influence on me. And that's how I've seen the prism through which I've seen the stories of the Great War through individual people, I think is a really important part of it. And I know that's what engages many of you who listen to this podcast. So we'll just finish off this little interim episode with just a final bit of reflection on the pathways of the Great War, the battlefields of the Great War itself. Now, aside from looking through all these books and papers and all the other archives that form part of my old frontline collection, as it were, it's made me, of course, reflect as well on journeys across the battlefields. Here I am now, much nearer to those battlefields of the Great War. And I'm sure, like many of you who listen to this podcast, the Great War is never far from my mind, and those battlefields are never far from my mind either. And it's interesting to think about journeys that I've made in the past and ones that I plan to make in the future. And looking at those papers of Malcolm Vivian, that made me think about a part of the Western Fronts that perhaps not many people go to. He was up in northern Flanders. So during the Third Battle of Ypres, he wasn't taking part in the fight for Passchendaele or across the Brunsinder Ridge or Polkapel or any of those places. His siege battery was sent up to the northern sector of the Western Front, where the British had taken over. There was a planned operation up there, Operation Hush, where they were going to land on the Belgian coast to bypass that part of the Western Front and take out some of the German gun positions up there and go for the submarine bases, commando-style raid that we would have called it. And that never happened because they didn't really have the ability to kind of pull that off in the First World War, and it probably would have ended in a terrible massacre if they'd have attempted it. But British units served on that top end, that perhaps beginning of the Western Front, close to the town of Nieuport and near to the village of Ramskapelle, in that northern sector of the Western Front in 1917. And Malcolm Vivian was up there giving them fire support. He was between Pervyse and Ramskapelle and Nieuport on regular bases. And there's a big, tall observation tower in Pervyse that some of you may have seen, a big concrete structure that was, I think, built up inside either some kind of tower or a mill or something like that. And he was up that spotting for his guns. It was a very static part of the front. The front lines in many parts of that sector were either side of the Yser Canal, that old medieval canal that went from Ypres up towards the coast, with the Allies dug in on one bank of the canal and the Germans dug in on the other side. There was a lot of flooding following the opening of the sluice gates on that northern Flanders plain in 1914. And so access to the frontline area was often across kind of bridges or pontoons. Strange, strange part of the Western Front. And then right up on the coast, that was where the front lines either began on the beach or ended on the beach, depending on how you looked at it, where literally the trenches continued through the sand dunes right up onto the beach itself. There was barbed wire on the beach, barbed wire in the water. Charles Dewey, an officer of the Dorsetshire Regiments, his battalion, which was part of the 32nd Division, was up in that sector in the summer of 1917. In his book, The Weary Road, he describes how he'd look out from his trenches there down towards the channel and see the barbed wire in the water, and on a moonlit night it would glint, the moonlight would glint against the wire in the water. Strange, strange part of the Western Front. And Malcolm was up there in that sector. It was an area where there was quite a lot of activity at different points in the war. And although the British never carried out Operation Hush and that landing, the Germans got wind that there was British troops up there, and they launched an attack there in July of 1917, just before the Third Battle of Ypres, which pushed the British lines back, and several battalions got overrun, Northamptonshire's and the Kingsroy Rifle Corps. We discussed the Nieuport Memorial that's up on that part of the front, and the King Albert Memorial that stands proud on the edge of Nieuport. He was the one that gave the order to open up the sluice gates and flood the Yser Plain to stop the Germans advancing through there in 1914. His statue looks out across those battlefields. It was an area greatly visited in that interwar period in the 1920s and 30s by battlefield tourists. There were at least two trench museums there during that period, one very near to the Nieuport Memorial, no trace of it now, and one not far down the road. There's quite a lot of postcards of trenches and cupolas and bunkers and so on that would form part of those trench museums in that area, with another one a little bit further down at Dixmude as well, near to where the Yser Tower is today. So it was an area, being close to Ostend, which was a main port in which visitors came into that part of Flanders, it was an area that a lot of visitors went to. When you look at photo albums, and I was looking at one that I've got the other day, there's quite a few pictures from that part of the battlefield where people went there in that interwar period. And I've walked that bit of the front myself because it is an interesting part. You can walk up onto the beach, you can walk along there. The terrain hasn't changed a lot, and it kind of made me reflect. And I mentioned earlier in the podcast that, you know, now being down here in Kent, being able to get over to the battlefield is a lot easier, that we're going to start making some films about these battlefields. And one of the early ones that we're going to start looking at is the start of the Western Front at Nieuport and what we're going to find there and tell that story. So that will probably end up becoming a video podcast, a film for the YouTube channel, and probably an audio podcast here for the Old Frontline podcast as well. Because as with all these stories, there is just so much material to kind of share, really. So that's got a taster, really, of what's to come. And you know, I think it's important to tell these wider stories of the First World War. I was looking at a Facebook group last night and someone was saying, you know, don't just visit the Somme, go here, go there. And that's true. You know, it's the Somme is what draws many people in. Flanders, the same, the battlefields around Ypres. But there's so much more to these battlefields of the Great War. So much more, I think, for for us to explore and understand here on the podcast. And we're, I think we've gone past something like 160 episodes or whatever it is now. And someone was asking me the other day, you know, have you told the entire story yet? I mean, I don't think we've even covered a fraction of it, really. I think that's one of the beauties of a subject like this, is that there is so many levels to it, so much depth to it, so many stories. And I think that's what brings us back time and time again to that essential thing, ordinary men and women in those extraordinary times of the Great War that leads us down those pathways, those never-ending pathways of the old front line.
You've been listening to an episode of The Old Front Line with me, military historian Paul Reed. You can follow me on Twitter at SomCorps. You can follow the podcast at Old Front Line Pod. Check out the website at oldfrontline.co.uk, where you'll find lots of podcast extras and photographs and links to books that are mentioned in the podcast. And if you feel like supporting us, you can go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/oldfrontline, or support us on Buy Me a Coffee at buymeacoffee.com/oldfrontline. Links to all of these are on our website. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again soon.